Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens, at the heart of Irish homes for over 40 years. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
Now, my next guest will be familiar to many of you as a British journalist, broadcaster and political commentator. But his new book is a deeply personal story about the search for his Irish birth mother 45 years after she signed him over to be adopted. The book is called Finding Margaret, and Andrew Pearce joins me now. Good morning, Andrew.
Good morning, Claire. Thank you for having me.
Now, as I said, so many of our listeners will be very familiar with you from discussions we've had on this programme and others about Brexit, about the Conservatives, about British politics, and they might have thought you were as English as King Charles. Did you always know that you were Irish?
I had a hunch because I was adopted when I was three by my mum and dad, who lived in Swindon in Wiltshire, and they were Cockneys. They had three children already, but they adopted me age three. And the one thing I knew was that I was baptized Patrick. I didn't know my surname was Connolly until very, very many years later, but I always had a hunch that I was Irish. And in my Catholic school in Swindon, in junior school, the teacher would often say on St. Patrick's Day, everybody in the class has shamrock on March 17th, except Andrew Pearce. Why is that? And I'd say, because I'm English, sir. But actually, I sort of sensed even then I wasn't.
Mm-hmm. But then it's so interesting reading that you didn't start your search until you were in your 40s. Isn't that right?
Yeah, look, the point was, I had the most fantastic upbringing with mum and dad. They brought me into their home with three children already. There was no resentment I can recall from from my siblings. I always felt that the mum who adopted me was my mum. But there is that great curiosity that you fight, you resist. But the reason I didn't track Margaret Connolly down until I was nearly 50 was because I felt so guilty about my mum. I thought if she found out that I'd started looking for my birth mother, she would think in some way, wasn't I good enough for him? Wasn't my love for him enough? Was there a vacuum? Was he not fulfilled enough by the love that her and my father gave me? And it wasn't about the love, Claire. It was just about the sense of, where did I come from? Mm-hmm. I was the youngest of four. My siblings were, put it this way, stocky and blonde. I'm slim and dark. Mum was a woman who dieted all her life. And I didn't look the same. Obviously, I didn't sound the same. And I even spoke differently. They all had very strong Swindon accents. And I didn't, because I suspect the way I spoke was defined in the orphanage, which was run in Cheltenham in Gloucestershire. And it was run by the nuns of Nazareth House, the Sisters of Nazareth. And I suspect that's how I learned to speak. And to this day, I speak differently to my siblings. I just kept putting it off until I was getting close to 50. I thought, if I don't do it now, it might be too late.
It's a lovely tribute to the mother who adopted you, that you considered her, you know, and her feelings till you got to that point, to almost the age of 50. But you mentioned where you learned how to speak and where you suspect your accent came from. So maybe that's a good time to go there, because you wrote about how your mother brought you to that children's home when you were 5 weeks old. You had always thought, well, she must have been very young when that happened. Then it turns out that she wasn't. She was almost 35, wasn't she?
It was a complete shock, because when I was nearly 50, I thought, Margaret, I'd found who she was. I'd got her details. I thought she was probably 16, 17, maybe 18 when she had me. Thought perhaps she'd fallen for that old line some of the boys tried when I was still at school. If you do it standing up, you don't get pregnant. So I thought perhaps that's what had happened. And then when I got the file, you write to your local social services. They then got my adoption file from the Sisters of Nazareth. The order is still going strong. It's based in Hammersmith now, the main convent. And there it said in bold black and white, your birth mother was around 29 when she had you. My journalistic instincts kicked in immediately. Around 29? Why don't they know how old she was? And then, of course, when I started researching her after I'd found her, I discovered she was 3 weeks from her 35th birthday. A complete shock, because I just assumed she'd been a teenager. So was she in some extraordinary love affair? Because you don't normally get a single mother of 35 in 1961. She was a nurse. She was a qualified nurse. She knew the rules. She knew the ropes. She also could have found a way to have me aborted, even though it was illegal in those days. She'd have known how to do that. So was she in some extraordinary love affair, which is why she had me so late and also carried on visiting me in the home till I was over two.
Well, she had planned, you found out, to come back and get you.
She was intent that there was a prospect of marriage and that she would then be able to have me, take me one day out of the home and bring me up as her own child. Now, for whatever reason, that prospect of marriage didn't work out. And when I started the search for Margaret, I wasn't, frankly, Claire, very interested in my birth father because I thought he was probably not very... It was just a chance encounter, a mistake. But I think perhaps she was involved in some great love affair. And for some reason, it didn't work out. Now, the adoption file told me there was a father figure. He was named. He was from Galway. Margaret was from County Mayo, and I've been to where she's from, and it was a very poor part of County Mayo, right by the ocean. And he was from County Galway, and he was allegedly run over by a car just 3 weeks after Patrick, as I was then, was put into the children's home. So if he was my birth father, well, then the marriage prospect was over. But why did she then not decide to give me up for adoption immediately? Because there was no prospect of a single mother back then in 1961. Irish Catholic, her family didn't know anything about me, nobody knew anything about me. I was born in Bristol, she worked in Birmingham, she took no chances that anybody would find her. If he was my birth father, then I think she would probably have given me up for adoption. So was he a cover? I write in the book that was he perhaps what they called in the day a toe tag father? He was struck by a car. He was dead by the time he hit the ground. I even managed in the book to find the man who was standing next to him when he was killed. So when his body then goes to the local Birmingham hospital where she worked as a nurse, did he come in? No relatives, no next of kin, name tag on his toe. Did she then think he'll do, he's a good cover, and it would have made her story more respectable with the nuns?
Yes, and that was something, you know, that happened from your research, that rather than put father unknown on the birth cert, yeah, it was better to have a name. And you haven't, yeah, been able to get to the bottom of that side of things, have you?
No, well, I found his family, and they're still in Birmingham, and they're still family in Ireland. And they say he was called Jimmy Coffey or James Coffey. I spoke to his brother, who's still alive, who said, I didn't know anything about my brother, A, having a girlfriend, B, having a child out of wedlock. I think he'd have told me I was his twin.
Ah, okay. Okay. So that side of things remains a mystery.
Very confusing. I mean, I said I was going to solve the mystery of my birth mother, Claire. I haven't, because she is a mysterious figure.
Well,
and when I got the file from the social worker, she said, this is the most complicated case I've ever seen, because your birth mother went to extraordinary lengths to never be found, even back then.
Right. But you did find her.
I did.
With the help of your friends, names who people might recognise, Jane Moore and Amanda Platel, the journalists, they were with you all the way. Even up to the point where, you know, Amanda went up to Margaret's door when you eventually located her.
It was extraordinary because we found her. So we took great advice on how to approach her, because if you write to her, somebody might open her letters. We didn't know what mental state she was in, if she had early onset dementia or something, because there's me thinking my birth mother would be in her early 60s. Of course, she was 80 odd when we found her. So don't write to her, don't call her, because it could startle her and she could just hang up and be spooked and think it's a fraud. The advice was send a friendly female face to the door. So I'm waiting in a taxi around the corner. Amanda knocks on the door, nobody in. I'd been really emotionally psyched up for this. And I was in a cab literally around the corner from her house. And a few minutes later, I was literally looking out the back window of the cab and I saw a dot emerging on the horizon. And I called Amanda immediately and said, she's coming. She said, who's coming? I said, Margaret. She said, what do you mean? I said, she's walking down the street. She said, how do you know? I said, I don't know, but it's her. I couldn't even see at that point, Claire, whether it was a man or a woman, but there was this lurch in my stomach. Mm. My heart was spinning. And as she got closer, I can't even say, oh yeah, I look like her, I've got her cheekbones, which indeed I do have. I just knew it was her. And she lived in a little semi-detached house in Birmingham, a suburb of Birmingham. If she turned left up the top of the garden path, it wasn't her. If she turned right, it was her. And Amanda rang, she said, she's turned right. I said, I told you, it's Margaret.
Wow.
She denied it, and she denied it was her initially. Not surprising. This was something she probably thought had gone away 45 years ago. She hadn't seen me for 45 years. We went to the local pub, drank a terrible bottle of wine, as I recall. And then I had to say to Amanda, you have to go back. And she did.
So she went back that day and knocked on the door, did she? Hmm.
She did. I'd put a note through Margaret's door saying, I'm Andrew Pierce. I'm happy. I'm content. I have a lovely adopted family who love me very much. I don't want a new mother. I just perhaps would like to meet you and talk to you. And maybe you could answer some questions. I've still got the note at home. And so she had time to read that and reflect. And when Amanda went back to the door, she opened the door and she was quite emotional. And she said, I've been praying to Our Lady for you to come back. I'm his mother. And I'll see him. But she wouldn't see me there and then because she was worried that her family might turn up on her doorstep. So we met some weeks later, not quite where I imagined, Claire, in the cafe in the British Home Stores in Birmingham Town Centre. I thought we might go somewhere a bit smarter, but that was what she wanted.
Listen, just to go back to that, you know, that sense you had that this was her when you spotted her in the rearview mirror walking along. Did you have any memory of her from your childhood? Do you suspect that there was something that you remembered?
I'm not sure I do, but I had this dream as a child when I was a little boy, when Mum and Dad took me into their home. And of course, I was Patrick, and they changed my name to Andrew Pierce. They kept James. I was Patrick James Connolly. I used to have this recurring dream, and there was a child in a cot, in a pram or a pushchair, a pram, and there was this woman who was vaguely above the pram pushchair. I now know that dream was Margaret. Because it was, I could see the resemblance, and so this drips. Because I don't know whether a little boy, do you have juvenile dementia at age 3? Do you just block it out, or do you forget it? But this dream went on and on, and then when I found her, the dream came back, and I thought that was Margaret I was dreaming of when I was a little boy. So there was some recollection, but I just think there is a link between mother and child that can't be broken. Even if it's only a few days or a few weeks old, I think I'd have known her if she'd stopped seeing me after 5 weeks, let alone 2 and a bit years, because she was visiting me for best part of 2 years, 2.5 years.
It's all incredibly sad. I feel really sad listening to you describe it.
The sad thing was too, I mean, I assumed that Margaret was in Bristol because that's where I was born, but actually she lived in Birmingham, so she managed to get me born in Bristol, 100 miles from where she lived and worked, so nobody would know. And I spent 2 years after my first job was on the Gloucestershire Echo in Cheltenham. Extraordinary. Where was the orphanage? Cheltenham. But it had been demolished by the time I got there. Then my second job was on the Birmingham Mail. Margaret lived in Birmingham, so I was on the Birmingham Mail for 2 years. I might have passed my birth mother in the street and not known. My office was literally 3 miles from her home. There were all these opportunities, but I still think she was drawing me to her. It was meant to be. She was drawing me and drawing me. But the sad thing was, when we did get together and we met up that first time, she didn't ask me a single question about my life, my upbringing, which was surprising, but I guess she had her reasons.
That really puzzled me, your description of that first meeting in British Home Stores, as you said, having a cup of tea. She told you a lot about her life, and she had gone on and been married and had her own family and so on. But nothing, she didn't ask you anything about you.
Not a question. She married a man called Patrick, which I was quite struck by because I was Patrick. And she had 4 children. The third son she called Patrick. And I looked her in the eye and said, did you think of me when you called him Patrick? Nothing. No, she didn't register. I asked her about the orphanage. I don't remember. I asked her about who my birth father was. I don't remember. She'd either managed to bury me like nuclear waste, or she just couldn't open up the file because it was too painful. But I said to her again at the end, would you like to meet again? She said, I'd love to see you again. She kissed me on the lips and said, you've made my life because I'm so happy that you're happy. And part of the reason I'd found her was to let her know that I was okay. But we then arranged to meet in the same British Home Stores 3 times. And I was coming down from London each time, and she didn't show up.
Right.
It was very hard because I would call her half an hour before I was there, say, are you ready, Margaret? Are you on your way? I put my best scarf on. And something spooked her. and there was always an excuse why she didn't show up. But she didn't call me to say she wasn't coming. I didn't call the next day to say, sorry, I didn't get there. So I would then call and say, do you not want to meet me anymore, Margaret? I understand. Just let me know. I do understand. I do want to see you. You've got many questions to ask me and I can answer them for you. But she never did.
Do you think she was quite well at that time?
I do, because, look, she was 80-odd, but she was so compos mentis about marriage to Patrick Lennon, who came from Armagh in Northern Ireland, about her four children, and about her life as a nurse, and about going to Catholic Church in Birmingham twice a day, every day, doing the washing for the priest. She just had a mental block about her little boy called Patrick. And then she did get early onset dementia and moved into an old people's home. And oddly, Claire, I then used to go and visit her there, and we had some very lovely times together, because her terrible fear of being found out, her terrible fear about the secret that she was still keeping, who was she covering up for? Was it still the doctor, the married lover? The fear had gone. So she would just chat away to me very animatedly. But even then, even in her sometimes confused state, nothing was revealed about Patrick, the little boy she put in the children's home, and loved. I think she loved me, which is why she used to visit me so often. Still, she kept the guard, but the fear had gone. And probably it was me who was fearful, because I always used to think, what happens if her children turn up and
well,
think,
that's what
what's
I was
this
going
well-known
to...
British did... journalist doing here?
Did she ever tell her family about
no.
you? And you've never met them or made contact with them then?
No, I had to let them, because I wouldn't have written this book if my mum was alive, because I never told mum what I did. And when I told my big sister that I found Margaret and told her I was doing a book about it, she was very emotional, but she was emotional because I hadn't told mum that I'd found. And she said that was the right thing. Mum would have been devastated. But Margaret asked me to stop writing to her, because she used to say, I worried if the good Lord takes me in the night, my children will find your letter. And there'll be a lot of explaining to do. So, excuse me, just before the book came out, I contacted her family. The four children, they're all in still in Birmingham, and she's still got family in Ireland, of course. And I had to let them know. And it was a very difficult conversation, because they had absolutely no idea at all. And I spoke to her daughter, Anne, and on the phone, and I arranged to speak to her on the phone, and she didn't know what the conversation was about. She knew exactly who I was as a journalist, which made it a bit more confusing. I had to explain to her
I'm your half-brother.
I'm your half-brother, and that was a big shock to her. But I said to her, I know you're struggling because your mum didn't tell you. I said, but don't love your mum any less. Don't think any less of her. She had her reasons to keep that secret from you, and she had her reasons not to tell me or share with me anything about why I was in the home for so long, who she was hoping to bring me up with, who my father was. I said, so you just have to make it. And she said, but I'm just struggling with the idea that my mum carried this secret on her own for 50 odd years, 60 years. And it must have been so painful for her. I said, well, I think she managed to bury it for years and years until I returned to her life. And then I think she sort of buried it again. She did her Catholic duty. She saw me, but didn't tell me anything.
And how have you managed to deal with all of this? Because that part where you have those arranged meetings with her and she doesn't show up and she doesn't want to tell you anything about the circumstances of your birth and your adoption, they're incredibly hard things to cope with.
They were, actually, and I didn't realise how difficult, but what I realised was a very good Catholic priest friend said, we've got to get you to see someone, because we've got to find Patrick and talk to Patrick. I said, Patrick, what do you mean? He said, Patrick's still here. Patrick's still there. He said, when Patrick moved to your mum and dad in Swindon, he didn't go away. He just retreated inside. He'd been rejected by his mother. That's how he would have felt, because she just stopped visiting me in the home. Don't know what how the nuns explained it. I'm not always sure the nuns were terribly compassionate, I'm afraid. Nazareth House has had some terrible stories, not the one I was in, but some others. He said, but then she's rejected you again. And so I actually had therapy, and I realised that all the rejections that little Patrick endured as a little boy manifested itself when she didn't see me at British Home Stores those three or even four times. Mm-hmm. So I never thought this hard-nosed political journalist who's used to having fights with prime ministers and foreign secretaries would be sitting in a therapist's chair. But indeed I did, and it was incredibly good for me and constructive, and a lot of stuff came out that I didn't know had been locked away for 50 years.
And probably really necessary as well, given what you've been through.
Yeah.
And it's been cathartic for a lot of people who have read about your story, because I see you're writing in the Daily Mail today. You've been overwhelmed with all of these letters, emails, phone calls from people who read your story, and they say that their experience mirrors yours, or yours mirrors theirs.
Quite extraordinary, actually. Some were in the same orphanage as me. Some were from Australia, America, because people have read it on Mail Online. And they wanted to just tell me that they'd been through similar experiences where a birth mother had turned them away, or they felt inspired to find their birth parent. And you realise, actually, there are thousands of us out there, and we don't talk about it. But also, some do. You go on the programme, that folk programme on British television, I've forgotten what it's called. It's got Davina McCall on it, and it's always a cosy, sweet, happy ending. Mm-hmm. This didn't really have a happy ending. And what those letters showed me, and those emails and those phone conversations, were people were glad that someone actually told it as it is. It isn't always gloriously happy when you try and find a birth parent. It doesn't always work out how you expected. It wasn't all sweetness and light. Margaret was gave away very little. She'd made her decision in 1963. She got married to Patrick Lennon when I was still in the orphanage. I always think, in full white regalia, because I've seen the wedding photograph. I always think, when the priest says, "Does anyone know of any lawful impediment?" What if somebody shouted from the back, "Oh, what about the little fella in the orphanage 60 miles up the road?" But just shows how tough she was, that she was able to do that. And, you know, I'm glad she did. She saw a chance of happiness and got it. And when she saw me, I think she decided, I'm okay, I'm successful, happy, I'd had a lovely life with my mum and dad, not that she asked anything about it. I felt she just didn't feel she needed to share mm-hmm. anything with me, because perhaps it would have been too painful for her to open up that box again.
And do you have, it sounds to me like you have compassion for her and that you understand her.
I went to a radio interview with Jeremy Vine, with Amanda Patel, and Amanda Patel just interrupted and said, "I'm sorry, Andrew is very charitable and compassionate about his birth mother. I think she was cruel. What she did was cruel. I think she was cruel leaving him in the children's home for all those years when he could have been adopted as a baby. And she was cruel to leave him standing outside British Home Stores, because I was there with him on one occasion." And she said it was one of the most heart-stopping moments I've ever seen. He was completely distraught. I wasn't crying. I was just confused and baffled why she would do that a third time. But I still think you have to make allowances. What she went through was very difficult, and she clearly thought she could give Patrick a chance. So she kept visiting me in the home, and probably what she should have done was given me up for adoption straight away. But she didn't, for the best reasons.
Andrew, it's a great pleasure to talk to you, and it's a fascinating story, and one that I know is familiar to very many of our listeners. And the book is called Finding Margaret, Solving the Mystery of My Birth Mother by Andrew Pearce, and it is out now. Andrew, thank you so much for telling us your story.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.